This is Talk for Food. Second half of Talk for Food gets started right here and right now on webtalkradio.net with Adam Abraham. And we're talking with Dr. Don Huber, professor emeritus of Purdue University. We're talking about glyphosate, otherwise known as Roundup, and the idea of which is now also a part of a whole infrastructure of input of genetically modified foods, genetically modified products, which are being put into the food chain. Now, some people would say that it's, or think that it's not directly being affecting them, but if it goes into feed, it is certainly going in terms of cattle, for beef and for dairy, then it is certainly going into human beings who consume them. There is no escape from these things, and yet these awarenesses were not part of how farming was done 30, 40 years ago when this started. According to Dr. Huber, it's only recently been even considered and not necessarily embraced yet today. You said there are some 30 years down the road. Is there really still a reason to use it at all? That's the first question I would have.
Well, certainly it's a very effective herbicide where it still works. It's a very cheap compound now. It wasn't initially, but it's pretty hard to beat the economics from an herbicidal standpoint where we don't have the resistant weeds. And it's been simple enough and effective enough that it's permitted a lot of growers that were struggling with weed control to be very successful. So as one farmer commented to me, it's made poor farmers look better and good farmers lazy.
Okay.
Well, in part, it's also given us an opportunity to do two very important things. One of those is get into a no-till situation, which we didn't have very effective means of doing on a prolonged basis. I'm not sure that's a plus. Mm-hmm. But at least it did give us an opportunity to get into a no-till.
Professor Huber refers to as a no-till or no-till farming is what he's talking about. And according to Wikipedia, no-till farming is a way of growing crops from year to year without disturbing the soil through tillage. And what is tillage? Is running a plow through and turning the soil over. No-till is an agricultural technique which increases the amount of water and organic matter, meaning nutrients, in the soil and decreases erosion. It increases the amount and variety of life in and on the soil, but may require herbicide usage.
And we've seen some erosion control benefits, and the economics also have been a factor for us now that it makes it a question as far as all the alternatives are a little more expensive. Mm-hmm. But I think as we look at the data, they more than pay for themselves if you know what alternative to choose. Mm-hmm. But it's given us another option that we didn't have before, and that's you can cover a lot more, farm a lot more ground than you did before.
Well, there also appears to have been a cost, though, all the way around with regard to the nutrient value of the food itself. I mean, ultimately, if the best amount of nutritional value is not present, you know, what's the point in farming?
Good question. Part of that's from ignorance or denial of that, but we've always had nutrient deficiencies. And we've compensated for them. We call that fertilization.
Okay.
It's just that this is a factor that reduces that efficiency even more, and we need to compensate much greater if we're going to maintain our quality. It's not that we can't. It's that we haven't factored that in. And if you start factoring in the other costs of a glyphosate program to maintain the same quality, then the economics aren't quite as skewed in its favor. And then if you look at all of the other side effects, the biggest concern I have personally is the residual glyphosate that's permitted in our food, because we can have up to 400 parts per million.
According to the FDA?
According to the FDA.
Okay.
And that's they, almost...
They say it's okay.
That's almost doubled in the past 5 or 6 years. As they increase the rate of glyphosate that they want to put out, they have to increase the tolerance level because, again, that seed is an accumulation point for the glyphosate.
Mm-hmm. Has
our, those tolerance levels are anywhere from 200 to 1,000 times higher than we find very significant toxicological mm-hmm. indicators for.
What would be an ideal in the sense of a growing per se? That means not even using glyphosate, not using herbicides at all. What would be the ideal?
Well, the ideal would be in a somewhat sterile environment without any weeds to challenge you and always have the right sunshine and the right moisture and the other things, which we never have. I mean, we're always in a situation where we have to change the environment. That seems to be man's lot in life, whether it's keeping warm in the wintertime or cool in the summer, or whether it's growing our crops. So that from a production standpoint, what we're shooting for is to maintain full nutrient sufficiency,
okay,
and minimum disease. And if we'll do that, we'll minimize a lot of the disease pressure. We can't control all diseases with nutrition, but even with our best controls, genetic control and chemicals, any of those still require nutritional sufficiency for them to be effective. Now, genetics would be our most effective and also our most efficient mm-hmm. means of disease control or pest control where it's available.
If there were, I don't know that I would expect a Monsanto or whomever to do this type of research, but if there were methods of pathogen control, if you will, that did not require the chemicals and the genetic alterations, do you see places where there would be, an openness to that?
Well, I think there are a lot of people that are very open to reducing the amount of pesticides. Most farmers would welcome being able to cut back on their chemical inputs to be able to improve the efficiency of their crops in other ways. It's just that you also have to do that economically.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could do it, and most growers are looking at the most economical ways to produce their crop, and they are very desirous of producing a quality crop. That's why in the presentation I have a section on trying to show them what to look for,
mm-hmm.
to see what these interactions are. It's amazing how many situations you'll find with very severe root rot type pathogens, and the grower is not aware of it because we don't dig the plants and we don't look at them.
Mm-hmm.
And also you have a plant that's quite robust so that it hides a lot of those symptoms. It's kind of like a person that may have a headache but doesn't complain about it.
Right, sure.
But it's certainly not optimum for that individual as far as their performance.
One of the things you mentioned, you talked specifically about the manganese and its characteristic of splitting the water molecule, but many of the pathogens and the life forms, talk about fungus and other types of things, mold, they thrive in an oxygen deficient environment. Where's the oxygen aspect here? If there was a way to get more oxygen and make it more available to the system, or is this a function of the lack of manganese?
It's a combination, but it depends on the organism, because we have organisms that are like Pythium and Phytophthora, much more severe under low oxygen conditions.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then we have those like Takeol and Phymetocotrichum root rot and Gibberella on corn that are more severe on very loose soils.
I see.
So very high oxygen soils. But neither one of them can you go to extremes on.
Right. Seems like about balance appears to be the issue here then.
And that's the whole situation. Now, we use those differences very efficiently for disease control, for instance. We change the environment so that it's more favorable for the plant from its resistance standpoint, less favorable for the pathogen, or more favorable for those disease control organisms that are going to control the pathogen. But it's really, again, those four components in a diamond, how they interact, and then how we manipulate them. Mm-hmm. And we do that all the time with our management programs. 30 years ago, we started out on a direction of one chemical agriculture. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, we lost a lot of the management options that we had. When we went to no-till, we threw away a lot of our natural disease control processes because we said sanitation is no longer necessary. So when you go to the bathroom, you can tear down that sign that says, before you leave this room, wash your hands.
All right.
And that's kind of what we do in no-till. We leave all that residue up there as for the pathogens, and especially there's quite a large group of organisms that if you just turn it over, bury that residue, those organisms like anthracnose and some of those can't survive against the competition with the soil organisms, and as soon as that residue is decomposed, we have good disease control.
So
what we've done then, we have to rely on other factors, changing other factors, rather than that particular emphasis that we used to have. And it's a matter of management, a matter of understanding the system so that we can manage it to maintain optimum productivity and quality.
Is there a general, you know, can almost speak in terms of 30 years ago when this began, but even today, but is there a general appreciation that the dynamics that we see in the microbial in terms of function and dysfunction that we see translates eventually into human disease pathologies? I mean, that what we are seeing and what we're putting into the soil, even from a chemical standpoint, is also having a similar types of effects in human health or disease now?
We're just starting to look at that.
Okay.
Now you have doctors that have Ames at the University of California Medical School, and you have a number of others who focus their life on particular diseases and then recognize the nutrient tie with that, and then kind of shifted over and looked at the nutrient as a means of reducing those diseases or even as control for those. I mean, you have the Balex and a number of those people. Ames, I'm familiar with a lot of his work at California because he's looking at nutrient sufficiency in a population base and then focuses on overall remediation of that deficiency on it. But we've recognized that, but we haven't always looked at it as a system overall.
Or connected, and, so to speak.
Yeah.
Okay.
We look at it as kind of an ad on a piece of paper rather than just a leaf out of the novel.
I would imagine that that's also the case when we go into the conversation of using genetically altered or modified products as well. I mean, how do you feel about, you know, we were talking about alfalfa, in 5 years there may be nothing that is not genetically modified. As a scientist, how do you see that?
Well, as a scientist, it bothers me because it's an irreversible change. If it was a reversible change, like you see with our annual crops, then that's different. No question that genetic engineering is a very powerful tool for us. And some of the dialogue that we get into now polarizes us so that we don't have the capability or the ease and comfort in using some of the tools that we have that are given to us to use because they're so polarized or they're so abused. In this situation, I believe it's extreme abuse of science.
Well,
and I have no reservations in making that.
Mm-hmm.
But also recognizing that it's a powerful tool if it's properly used.
Well, it seems to be if it needs to be, if it's understood well enough, because if it can't be reversed, or should I say if we don't yet know how to reverse it, then that should be the restraint to understand we do not know how to reverse this. We should not be moving forward without the knowledge.
True.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of questions that have never been asked.
Yes.
That need to be asked in this whole process.
Mm-hmm.
We've asked them for most other products. This one hasn't, because it's been touted as the silver bullet.
Oh.
It's not the silver bullet.
That's right.
For we've never seen a yield increase by putting the gene in.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen some yield declines. Now you can see an increase if you have severe need for BT. You can also get that with some chemical controls and even some management options.
Mm-hmm.
Give us some the same benefit. It's not an absolute requirement in any respect.
Right.
Usually it's a drag.
Yes.
Unless we compensate for that, we kind of shoot ourselves in the foot.
You're right. And you know, even if you take looking at other products that have been genetically modified, that drag that you mentioned has shown itself there. If we look upon the others as even an indicator, it's going to indicate that probability for alfalfa as well.
Well, we already know it for alfalfa.
Mm-hmm.
When we had our dairy, we wanted a little grass in there. We planted some orchard grass and a few other things in because you had a better nutrition for your ruminant animals. We didn't want just straight alfalfa.
Mm-hmm.
In a glyphosate program, you have straight alfalfa. Then you need to get your other forage somewhere else, or your other roughage there. You can do it through silage, and you can do it through some other factors. But for alfalfa, I've never seen any justification for Roundup Ready alfalfa.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it's counterproductive for us, and especially when you recognize that you're going to have lower nutritional quality and the extreme impact of that on our dairies and our herds and our animals, our cattle, any ruminant animal or sheep that need that nutritional advantage in that alfalfa, and we've compromised it.
Mm-hmm.
So that you even look at hybrid corn or hybrid crops. The primary reason for a hybrid corn isn't for increased yield, because Sprague demonstrated years ago at the University of Missouri that he can make more progress in a breeding program through the traditional breeding of selfing than you can through a hybridization. You lose a couple of years in hybridization.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for hybridization was for proprietary control, so the company
right.
could control its seed.
Right, so we can brand it. Yes.
And so when you put a genetic engineering, that's essentially what you've done there, except you've also then put a tech fee with it.
Mm-hmm.
And as the courts have ruled, an ownership of the crop.
Well,
regardless of who's growing it or who's purchased it, it's kind of like buying a car from General Motors, but General Motors always owns that car regardless of how much you pay for it.
Yes, yes. This, I understood that we had antitrust laws, and I came up through a time where AT&T was broken up and different types of firms were broken up, and yet I see no evidence of that type of oversight with regard to this, and this is far more pervasive in its effect than anything an AT&T could have done years ago.
Well, there are several factors that come into play. One is that, kind of like the guy that said he didn't have a clear conscience, just a poor memory. And we seem to have a very poor memory on the abuses that come through monopoly type systems. But the other thing that we lose is the ingenuity, the innovation. And we saw that even in the old program where we used to have an agricultural research program and a land grant system that encouraged innovation.
Right.
And it also encouraged problem solving. And so there was no centralized control. The control went, all of that hatch money went to build up your agricultural and engineering colleges and the land grant schools. But there was a set allocation that went to each state, somewhat based on population and some other things, but at least there was a base allocation that that state could meet its needs and start working on its problems. Now they all work together in those problems that were larger than a particular state boundary, but you still had that individual innovation. We then, in my career, I've watched this process go from, I had the blessing of starting my career when we still had a very strong land grant system of innovation-driven individual efforts and input.
And it was for the good of humanity. It was for the good of society. It seems today it's for the good of a profit or a patent.
True. But you had that individual innovation. We then moved to research centers because there are a lot of research that you have to have a critical mass in either equipment or personnel to get to make the ideas work.
Sure.
The ideas still originate on an individual basis. Then you had the emphasis there, and then everything started moving to these compound type of centers. And then pretty soon we started moving to a national driven directive of what are our priorities, and we saw all the calamity that comes in the conservation movement and everything through that.
Sure.
Where politically you would have one program emphasize 1 year, and 5 years down the road you emphasize another aspect that dried up or that totally destroyed what you'd emphasized 5 years ago because there wasn't recognition that one size doesn't fit all systems.
Well, it's true, and it also got down to who's funding the research oftentimes. Well, I appreciate your candor and your sharing, because this is something that is, again, it applies it to everyone. It affects everyone. And the public needs to understand, and perhaps it's not like we're going to all go out and be farmers per se, but we do need to understand that what is produced on the farm shows up in the marketplace, in the supermarket, and the quality of what's produced affects the quality of human life. And that's this is of importance to everyone.
Well, and as you indicate with the antitrust, the farmer's a victim, just as much as the consumer, because he doesn't have the flexibility. There are a lot of regulations that he has to comply with.
Sure.
There's a lot of company restraints and restrictions on products that he uses as far as how he can use them. We have all the limitations and very little opportunity for innovation, even in industry. It's become so big that you no longer see that big breakthrough coming. We're seeing the opposite of that, as everyone seems to think we've reached that Platonian plateau of seeing things already have reached the pinnacle on the mountain when we're still down in the foothills.
Well, something else has got to come from this, and this is perhaps the beginning, but I want to thank you for your time and your wisdom. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
After talking about and instructing and educating people on how to use glyphosate, on being in the mindset for so many years, it is refreshing and encouraging to see him seeing the effects, researching, noticing, and then informing us of the effects. You also notice in that conversation where he says that the daily or the recommended or the allowable tolerated amount of glyphosate was in the face of the fact that we were using more and more and more of it. What the FDA did said is basically is that, well, the numbers that we're using right now, they just created a new one with a higher tolerance. There's no research behind all this. This is all expediency. This is our government at work. At any rate, that's all the time we have for this show. Thank you for being here. We are going to cover this subject more. We have a conversation coming up with one of the leading authors on the subject of genetically modified foods. That's Jeffrey Smith, and that's going to be coming up very soon. So in the meantime, be well, be yourself, be in love. Imagine the world as you desire it. No need to be angry at anyone, certainly not the people that appear to be our tormentors. The point is, give them love and give yourself love and imagine life the way you see it being. And until next time, if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, if you want to contact Dr. Huber, for example, as well, contact me at adam@talkforfood.com. I will forward your request, your information to you. Put glyphosate in the subject. And in the meantime, see you next week when Talk for Food returns on web at talkradio.net. Thank you for watching and listening. We'll see you next week.
Talk for Food is a Phylos Media Works production.